Hello, I'm William Seaman, and this is a special KABU public affairs feature focus on Israel-Palestine. This series of special programs looks back on the highly publicized Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. Leading up to and during the withdrawal, the world's news organizations reported the event as an historic concession on the part of the Sharon government as a step supporting the long-troubled peace process aimed at ending the decades-long conflict. The Sharon government was seen as struggling against the settler movement and against members of his own party in the decision to bring about the withdrawal from Gaza. Is there more to this story? We're very fortunate to have with us today, from his home in Haifa, the Israeli historian Professor Ilan Pappe. Ilan Pappe is author of The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1947 to 1951, and of The Israeli-Palestine Question. He is a professor of Middle East history at the University of Haifa and academic head of the Research Institute for Peace at Givat Haviva. Professor Pappe, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's begin with a brief history of Israel's occupation of Gaza and the reasons these settlers ended up there. Why did the State of Israel set up these communities in Gaza?
Well, we have to go back to 1967, to June 1967, when Israel, as part of its war against several Arab armies, ended up in victory and the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Now, these two areas are more or less 20% of original Palestine. So by the end of the war of 1967, the Jewish state, Israel, controlled 100% of what used to be Palestine, and not only the territory, but with it millions of Palestinians as well. And that started the debate inside Israel between people one can call the custodians, who believe that these areas can be given back either to the Arab world or to the Palestinians, with the hope of reaching a historical compromise with the Palestinians about the future of Palestine and Israel, and the redeemers, who believe that both the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, as the rest of Israel, were part of the ancient homeland of the Jews and therefore not negotiable. You can guess from the fact that settlements had been built all over the place, both in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, that the redeemers had the upper hand. And with the consent of the government, settlers were sent into the Gaza Strip. And ever since then, had been expanded, taking the best sources of water from the Palestinians. And anyway, this is almost an arid part of Palestine or Israel, and therefore there isn't much water altogether, and were protected by military bases, a big wall, and of course were a menace in the eyes of the local population that resented their presence and occasionally tried to hurt them. And in return, the Israelis retaliated quite brutally. So I think this is more or less a very short, in a nutshell, history of this Israeli settlement in the Gaza Strip.
Well, now, the news reports that we saw, very intense news reporting during the evacuation and, in fact, leading up to the evacuation, and typically these news reports seem to come from the settler point of view. That is to say, it was the feature story, this kind of theme was always that these people were being ejected from their homes, often from homes that they had lived in for two generations even. Was it reasonable to think of these houses and this land as belonging to the settlers?
No, not at all. I mean, we have to separate, of course, between a human story where people live in whatever reasons in a place for 30 years, and some people did live there for 20 or 30 years. And, of course, leaving one's home is not an easy event. But they were warned by the international community, they were warned by many good people in Israel itself, that they are going to settle illegally on someone else's land. And it was very clear, and these are learned people, these are people who know what's going on and had been knowing what was going on, that this is a disputed land and therefore in a prospective peace solution can be returned to its legitimate owners, which is what happened. And therefore, apart from the human story, which of course, as I said before, can be traumatic, basically on a legal and moral basis, the eviction of these settlers is justified. And what should add to this, what I said in answer to your previous question, they were not just neighborly settlers. They were really a menace to the population around them. They behaved like occupiers, not just as neighbors. And I think there was a big sigh of relief inside the Palestinian community when the majority of these settlers left, and life is still very difficult and very harsh in the Gaza Strip, but definitely more bearable since these settlers were removed.
Well, I want to turn to the context of this recent withdrawal. What were the shifts in government policy? What led to this withdrawal of Israel settlements from Gaza? But I wonder if you could make more concrete, when you describe the settler presence as a menace, what does that mean concretely in terms of how their presence affected the lives of the people who lived in Gaza?
Yes, I will give very short examples, but I think they're very illuminating. First of all, they took over by force, as I mentioned before, the water resources, and they dried out the Palestinians, just literally. They took the sweet water reservoir to themselves by force, not through government decision, but then the government approved of it in hindsight. Then they forced the government, whenever they felt like it, to expand the areas that belongs to them by building connecting roads, bypasses, and so on. And for these kinds of projects, more land was confiscated, Palestinian natural roots of Palestinians were cut, and Palestinians had to divert and for hours go from one spot to the other just because the settlements were located as a wedge between someone's house and someone's fields. And the more extreme among them occasionally would attack Palestinians. And the overall picture was that since this kind of conduct and behavior resulted in a Palestinian resistance, whenever a shot was fired at the settlements, the retaliation, the Israeli retaliation, was very harsh and very cruel. So the overall picture was very disturbing from the native people of Gaza's point of view.
Let's turn then to the political context for this withdrawal. What changed, or did anything change, in terms of the fundamentals of Israel's policy towards the occupied territories that would lead Ariel Sharon, who is often thought of as very supportive of the settlement policy, to bring about this withdrawal from Gaza?
Yes, this is probably the sad side of the story, although on the one hand we've just talked about a certain improvement in the life of the people of Gaza because the settlers and the settlements had been removed. Unfortunately, in the bigger picture, that of the chances of bringing about peace and reconciliation, to my mind, nothing significant has changed. On the contrary, I think that the Sharon government and Sharon himself had made a strategic decision about 3 or 4 years ago that the best solution for Israel is to give up the idea of the Greater Israel, which the group I called before the Redeemers had developed in 1967, namely to have the whole of Israel and Palestine as a Jewish state between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. They reached the conclusion that they cannot control all these areas, and they do not want to lose the Jewish majority. If they control all the area, the balance, demographic balance changes against the Jews. There are more Palestinians now between the river and the Mediterranean. So they came to the conclusion that they can give up some parts of what used to be mandatory Palestine. That is, some parts which are the whole of the Gaza Strip and half of the West Bank. Now, the half of the West Bank that they're willing to give up is not a continuous territory. It is fragmented or spread between different blocks of Jewish settlements. Now, they really think that this is the red line for themselves, for them and for the state of Israel. And Sharon believed that he could create such a picture of a national trauma, almost a civil war between Israel and the Israeli government and the settlers, that he hoped, and he keeps saying that, by the way, in the last few days he spells it out very clearly, that the world will not demand any more such evictions from Israel. That this would be the last serious eviction of settlements. And why is it bad news? It is bad news because it means that this is a consensual Israeli position. This is a position which is supported by the Labor Party in Israel, by the Likud party which supports Sharon, not by the right wing in the Likud. And the Israelis have the power and the force to impose that kind of solution on Israel and on Palestine. This will never set aside the Palestinians. This, in fact, doesn't mean any good news for the Palestinians, and it means that around the corner, awaits us another uprising, another cycle of bloodshed, because what is now accepted by the world at large as a peace proposal, as a peace process, and a prime minister which is hailed as a peacemaker, is actually not a peace process, but consolidation of the Israeli occupation. And Sharon is not a peacemaker. He's a typical Israeli leader who tries to get as much of Palestine, or what used to be Palestine, as possible, with as few Palestinians on it as possible. And I'm afraid that this is a formula for more bloodshed rather than the beginning of a fruitful or constructive peace process.
So you referred to this recent withdrawal as a show, in a sense, to reveal to the world the trauma of withdrawal, to indicate that Israel is making this very significant sacrifice, and that this is, in a sense, a way of selling the balance of the occupation in the West Bank.
That's right. That's right. And I was not surprised at all that the day after the withdrawal from the Gaza Strip ended, immediately there were new initiatives publicized to expand the settlements in the West Bank, and Sharon made some hasty trips into the major settlements in the West Bank, explaining that this is part of the State of Israel. I would like to add something else just to this point, maybe to clarify that even the term withdrawal, or the concept of withdrawal, is not really describing truthfully what happened in the Gaza Strip. It is true that settlements had been removed and had been removed forever. I'm quite adamant about that. However, this is not an end of the Israeli occupation, because the Israeli army was redeployed on the borders of the Gaza Strip. Now, the Gaza Strip, for your listeners who hadn't been there, and I'm sure many of them have not been there, is encircled from the north, the west, the east, the north, the east, and the south by a very high electric fence. The whole of the Gaza Strip. You cannot go in, you cannot go out. On the west, you have the sea, and the sea is patrolled by the Israeli Navy. This is a huge prison. Now, the settlers were part of this prison, but were protected in a certain enclave. Now, they were removed. They were moved out. The prison concept of the Gaza Strip is still there. It is still encircled by this huge fence. People cannot go out. People cannot go in. And the Israeli army has the keys to all the gates, so to speak, and can go in with a military force whenever it wishes so. And this can happen, you know. This can happen after the desperation would sink in the Gaza Strip and people would realize that not much has changed economically or politically, the more militant among them could start firing missiles into Israel or whatever primitive weapons they have. And this could bring about a very serious Israeli retaliation.
Now, does that prison concept refer also to the border with Egypt? There have been some reports indicating that Egyptian forces would take over security concerns at that border, which sounds like it could potentially be an open border for the Palestinians.
Yes, but very interesting. But what the Israelis want the Egyptians is not to control a passage. They want them to control... Again, it's very difficult when one doesn't see it. Because of the peace agreement between Israel and Egypt, a whole Palestinian town, the town of Rafah, was divided into two. And the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt runs through that city. And the Israelis found that that particular fence was not enough to stop from people crossing from one part of a town to a second part of the town. And there was also an industry of tunnels through which the Palestinian militants passed weapons and arms to their friends and comrades in the Gaza Strip. That particular route, which is called, for some obscure reason, Route Philadelphia, was given to the Egyptians. This is not a place where people can pass. This is a place which the Egyptians are supposed to replace the Israelis in keeping eye of the movement, traffic of weapons and even of drugs. The Israelis, and this is what the Palestinians are now objecting to, but we'll see whether they succeed. The Israelis said people who would want to go out of Gaza or into Gaza, even from Egypt, would have to go through an Israeli checkpoint first. So the Israelis would still have total control of all the entrances or the gates to and from Gaza.
Even if these were the motivations for the Israeli withdrawal, the idea that it would allow a consolidation of the occupation in the West Bank, how has the Palestinian Authority responded? What are their options, and what do you see emerging in Gaza after this removal of the settlements, if not an end to the occupation there?
Right. I think that there is a surprising pattern of continuity between the late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and the present Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen. I think they're both trying to live the day, maybe the day after, but no longer than that. I fail to see any strategic thinking on the part of the PA vis-a-vis this new reality that developed. And I think that, like Arafat before him, Abu Mazen awaits for the next crucial juncture to come or to arrive, and then he will make his decisions. In other words, he can still claim, and that's what he claims, it doesn't matter what the Israelis say, as long as the quartet, that is the United States, the United Nations, Russia, and Europe, which are the custodians of the present peace process, and do not accept the Gaza withdrawal as the final Israeli eviction, as long as this is the position of the international community, the PA trusts the community to pressure Israel to do this. Now, he knows better than that. He knows that at best he would be invited for a peace conference, as Arafat was invited in the summer of 2000 to Camp David. He would be presented with an Israeli dictate, as Arafat was, a much less serious Israeli proposal than in 2000, meaning he would be offered a Palestinian state which would be even smaller in size and in its capabilities than Arafat was offered in the summer of 2000, and he will be asked to accept it as a final peace solution. And my guess is, like Arafat before him, he will not accept it, and we will see kind of a farcic repeat of history where he will come back and, of course, the people on the ground would feel that their power is needed again to show their resentment through another uprising. So on a strategic level, I don't think there is a position. On a tactical level, there is a constant reference to the international community. But far more than that, I think that we should be aware and recognize that the Palestinian Authority, apart from formulating a policy vis-a-vis Israel, is also failing in conducting the daily matters of the people which fall under its authority in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip. In many areas, it is not in control at all. It is rather the Islamic militant groups and other militant groups which control the space. It cannot provide employment. It cannot provide protection to the people from Israelis or from settlers. And it's an organization of 50 to 60,000 people which more or less takes care of these 60, 70,000 people, but doesn't fulfill the role of leadership or a state in potential or any other adjective that the international community likes to attach to this outfit.
Well, let's turn to this international community. You mentioned the quartet. It sounds as though you're fairly confident that this ploy by the Sharon government has succeeded, not only with the domestic population of Israel in terms of creating a consensus in support of holding on to the settlements in the West Bank, but that somehow this has succeeded with the international community as well. Do you genuinely feel that there will not be international pressure to bring about the withdrawal from the West Bank?
Yes, unfortunately I do. When I say the international community, of course I mean the governments and not the societies. I'm still a great believer in the possibility of civil societies in Europe and in America to pressure their own governments to change fundamentally the international community treatment of the Palestine question. But if this pressure from below in Europe and in America would not emerge or would not be intensified and strengthened, I'm very fearful that the pragmatic nature, and I say it as a negative term, not as a positive term, the pragmatic nature of the international relation system we live in is such that when it comes to the question of Palestine and Palestinians on the one hand and Israel and the Jews on the other, the community would rather go with the realities on the ground than trying to change them by force, which is not what the community does in other parts of the world. But when it comes to Israel and the Palestinians, if the community is asked to make a very serious shift in its attitude towards Israel, in the near foreseeable future, I cannot see it happening. Of course, things can change. Nobody is a prophet. For instance, I think much depends on the way American policy would develop. Europe doesn't have an independent mind of its own, it seems, and even when it tries to have an independent mind, eventually it toes the American line. But I think much depends on the American line, and this depends on the quagmire in Iraq, how things are going to develop there. What would be the effect of the present crisis in New Orleans on the American position worldwide? I mean, these things have to be watched very carefully, because I think they eventually, in the end of the day, they will also impact the American position vis-a-vis Israel. Just a small reminder that money-wise, Israel is the country that receives most of the American foreign aid today, aid which probably is needed in the south of America, in the south of the United States. These are strategic priorities of the United States that may be reconsidered given the present crisis. But I think it's too premature to analyze it in such a manner. If the present balance of power in the international system remains as it is, I'm very pessimistic of a scenario in which one could see the quartet taking real action to force Israel to continue with the withdrawal from the West Bank. And it would rather accept an Israeli kind of a semi-proposal, and maybe the Israelis would succeed in getting with them one or two Palestinian collaborators to for that matter. And this will hold on for a year or two, and then, of course, everything will collapse, and then a third intifada, a third uprising would come.
Well, I'd like to give you a chance to touch on other dimensions of these recent events that you think we haven't talked about so far, and also perhaps give us your perspective. You have, in a sense, already, for what role the U.S. public can play or ought to play. What do you see as perhaps the most promising dimension of work on this issue from abroad?
Yes. Well, I think these two issues can really nicely sum up what I was trying to say. I'll talk about the optimism that I derive from developments in the domestic scene here in Israel and in the international one. In the domestic scene, I think not in the near future, but for a longer-term future, there are the beginning of awakening of groups of people, both Israelis and Palestinians, that understand that their lives have to be salvaged from the political elite. And they are trying to build a different reality in which the ethnic or national origin of a person is less important than it is now. And therefore, I think they are the beginning of a development that would lead eventually, I hope so and I believe it will, to a very different political structure, which would be more or less one state or a federated state rather than the two-state solution, which I think has gone. It is not relevant anymore. Now, as far as the near future is concerned, there is a great need here for international help. And there's nothing much that the good forces on the ground from within can do. And I'm very encouraged by the fact that in America, certain churches and certain communities and definitely around Europe and the world have understood that it's not an anti-Semitic act to regroup and coordinate their actions and ask the governments to pressure Israel to withdraw unconditionally from the areas it had occupied in 1967 and in which it has no business to stay. And I think that the same kind of good energy that I have seen during the emergence of the anti-apartheid movement in Europe during the time of apartheid in South Africa seems to repeat itself. Definitely in Europe, but also in America. And I think that these energies would be eventually translated into some sort of a political force that can change the balance here in Israel and Palestine, and will stop the victimization of the Palestinians, which as a result brings victimization of the Israelis, because the Palestinians retaliate as normal people would do. And hopefully this kind of pressure from below, as I call it, but I mean from very high up, of the civil society, would show the way to the governments of the day, who seem to have lost it when it comes to the question of Israel and Palestine.
Well, you've been listening to a special KABU Public Affairs feature focus on Israel-Palestine. We've been speaking with Professor Ilan Pape from the University of Haifa in Haifa, Israel. Professor Pape, thank you for joining us today.
It was a pleasure, Will.
And I'm William Seaman. Thank you for listening.